Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go to bbc.co.uk/5live.
Good afternoon. You're listening to 5 Live Friday afternoon. So we have some movie conversation to come with Mark Kermode in his favourite place in the world, on the Croisette at the Cannes Film Festival. Mark, hello.
How are you going?
How miserable is it this year?
Well, I think everybody, including me, is fed up of hearing me complaining about it. So yep. I'm going to change my tune. I'm in a particularly good mood this year. And can I just say, on the subject of finding a camera which has got a picture of a murder on it makes a good story.
Which is what Daniel was talking about. Yeah. Daniel, say hello to Mark. Mark, say hello to Daniel.
Hello, Mark. Go on. Have you found a camera?
Hi, Daniel. No, but, you know, on the one hand, you have that. And then you said, on the other hand, you know, you find something which has got a picture of a bunch of people from the church not doing very much. Well, actually, you put the two of them together, you got the plot of The Da Vinci Code. And that's clearly where Dan Brown got it from.
That's, you know, why didn't I think of that before?
Exactly.
Then I wouldn't be the failed novelist I am today. I would instead be Dan Brown.
That's right. What a failure you both are.
I was only recently learned that the Da Vinci Code was not a genetic thriller. For some reason, it was in my head that it was a code of genes that made a genius, the Da Vinci Code.
Have you seen it?
No.
Have you
I'm
read
scared
it?
Of Tom Hanks's hair.
Got loads of emails, actually, about the aforementioned...
About Tom Hanks's hair?
No, just about the movie, because Mark went off on one, as he is prone to do last week, and we have people now, we've all had a chance to go and see it. People want to get their own back, basically. Some of them are agreeing with Mark, and some of them are not really agreeing.
Well, are there people who've sent an email saying it's good?
Yeah.
Really?
Do you want to hear one?
You have names and addresses?
Okay. I want to do more with Daniel, but actually...
no, it's fine, but...
No, I want to dive right into this Da Vinci Code controversy. As someone who hasn't seen the movie or read the book, I have firm opinions on the matter.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to find... There's absolutely loads of them.
Loads of them saying it's good?
Matt in Bristol saw Da Vinci Code on Wednesday, thought it was reasonable, slightly better than your review last Friday. The good doctor kept me in my seat for the 2.5 hours. Completely agree about the lighting, though. It's too dark. Okay with dark and moody films, like Seven, for example, but not that dark. The most annoying aspect was the silly dialogue to explain the blatantly obvious. Is it an anagram? Says Clouseau, accented French policewoman. Yes, an anagram, says long-haired ex-astronaut professor. There you go, the hair is featuring again. After Mark's...
I think it's an imitation of John Travolta in Pulp Fiction, but it's not, it's you know, I know John Travolta, I've worked with John Travolta, Tom Hanks, you know John Travolta.
I know John Travolta?
Not really.
No. This from... Sturdy, I believe it is. Simon, read the good doctor's review of The Da Vinci Code on last week's programme. My wife and I went to see the film last Saturday after listening to Mark's review, decided to adopt the critics, what do they know, approach. We decided to go for the following reasons. One, we'd not been to see an adult film without the kids for years. Two, Tom Hanks and Ron Howard are usually associated with good films, which is true.
Yeah, they are.
Three, if the film was that bad, then so what? I haven't read the book. Then I would know what all the fuss was about. Four, I'm an eternal optimist, in life, things are never as bad as they seem. So my comments are thus. Yes, the acting was a bit wooden. Yes, the plot was explained as if we were watching Jack and Ori. Yes, Mr. Hanks' character was weak. Yes, the film was half an hour too long. But on the other hand, the cinema was packed. Most importantly, we both came out of the film glad that we'd made the effort and feeling that we at least now know what all the fuss was about.
And it could have been longer and more wooden.
That's true. I got more satisfaction in seeing a film that had been panned and been pleasantly surprised than seeing a film that had been praised and coming away feeling slightly disappointed that it wasn't as good as all the hype.
If that is the best...
That's James Sturdy in Chichester.
Well, fine. So what you have there, the quotes that are going straight on the poster is reasonable, not quite as terrible as you said from one of them, and yes, wooden acting, yes, rubbish plotting, yes, terrible dialogue, but hey, there was a bunch of people there.
And it was only a half an hour too long.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, and I have to say, that's being kind to it.
Okay, well...
I mean, pulling your fingernails out with pliers is a plus in comparison with watching The Da Vinci Code.
If you have seen it and particularly have a positive thing to say, you know, an honest positive thing to say about the movie, because let's face it, it is critic-proof. It has taken a gazillion dollars, euros and pounds in its opening weekend, so it really doesn't matter what anyone thinks, because loads of people want to see it. And they want to see it, Mark, because of what James says. You know, they want to see what all the fuss is about, so...
What does James know? James thinks that Prime is a perfectly good movie for which he should be struck about the head with a newspaper.
James Sturdy, the listener who sent in that email, not James King.
Oh, I beg
King.
Your pardon. You're I meant James King, the radio...
Let's not go striking people on the heads with newspapers before we've
not if they're listeners. If it's James King, that's fine.
Now, on the subject of movies, Daniel, you were involved in writing the screenplay for Lemony Snicket, weren't you? For a while.
Yes, I wrote 8 drafts of the screenplay and then I was fired.
Why were you fired? It was your book.
I said, you know, I don't think I can do a ninth draft. And they said, that's funny. We were thinking the same thing.
Right. I probably wasn't given in quite such measured terms. So did that sour the whole thing for
you?
It
was actually just about in those terms. No, it was sort of a relief. It had been 5 years. And I didn't know. I didn't know if I could write another draft.
What was wrong with your eight drafts?
Well, nothing really. It was that there was this huge upset, and Barry Sonnenfeld had been the director of the motion picture, and I sort of wrote drafts of the screenplay for a Barry Sonnenfeld film to his specifications and to the producer Scott Rudin's suggestions. And then Mr. Rudin quit, Mr. Sonnenfeld was fired, and so then I was left with the eighth draft of a project that was actually now in other people's hands. So it was for the best, I think. The new director took over, and a man named Robert Gordon wrote the script, and so all compliments and complaints can be directed to him.
You quite liked it, Mark, didn't you, as I recall, the Lemony Snicket movie?
I did, actually. I thought it was perfectly fine. I mean,
so you thought it was better than having your fingernails torn out with, what was it, pliers?
Yeah, it was. Much, much better than that. Better than finding a video camera with some grisly murder or a bunch of people walking around a church in it. No, I thought it was good, and I liked the design, and it was one of those Jim Carrey movies that I enjoyed, as opposed to the Jim Carrey movies that make me lose the will to live.
Sure. Well, as long as you still have the will to live, that was what was important to me.
And do you think you're going to concentrate, once you've done Lemony Snicket and you've got your adverbs booked, Daniel, do you like to be, frankly, more in control, you know, and working with people saying that your work is not good enough? Really, you don't need that hassle, do you?
Well, I've written for other smaller films before. I like writing fiction most, where I'm alone in my room and I get to do whatever I want. But then occasionally it's nice to go out and do something at least quasi-collaborative. And, you know, they pay you.
That's
true. I don't
true.
Mean to be too crude about it.
Do you get to... Do you get
it's
to,
not volunteer work.
Do you get to the cinema that often?
No, I have a two-year-old.
Yeah, right. So do you have an opinion on Ice Age 2, The Meltdown?
No. I've also been on tour for a long time, so I haven't seen any of the movies that are just now coming into theaters.
So if we were going to do the box office top 10, you couldn't really provide us with pithy one-liners about the movies because you haven't seen them?
Well, I think they could be all the more pithy for not having seen them.
So you could just make something up?
Absolutely.
Okay, do you want to work with that?
Sure.
Right, okay, so this is how we traditionally start our movie review. So this is a UK box office top 10. Are you ready to go, Mark, there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, previews, reviews coming up, by the way, of The X-Men, The Last Stand, which comes out in the UK today, and Bug, and so therefore we're going to be speaking to William Friedkin, who's done a couple of movies in the past, and that's why Mark is in a good mood.
Mm.
So, at 10, Silent Hill. Mark?
It's an adaptation of a computer game. It's complete rubbish. It's not the computer game that's rubbish, it's the movie, and it's a shame because Christoph Gans is a good director, but it's rubbish.
I've seen the poster of the girl doesn't have a mouth. She looks sort of like an egg. I like eggs.
Good. Put that on the poster. At 9, 16 Blocks.
Perfectly good B-movie posing as an A-movie with a top-ranked cast. And have we now got the definitive Mos Def name? What is it? Gertrude Stein was my last week's thing, and I'm sticking with that.
Something like that. 16 Blocks, Daniel?
I've never heard of 16 Blocks, some kind of numerology film.
Bruce Willis,
I presume.
Most Deaf, taking a prisoner, 16 Blocks gets
shot. My sister went to a Most Deaf concert and he took 5 hours to show up, so unforgivable. Okay. Terrible film.
Brick at number 8, Mark?
Sort of Dashiell Hammett goes to high school, very, very inexpensive, actually quite interesting, not quite the masterpiece that some people think it is, but pretty good.
Dante Smith is the real name of Mos Def, and as we said a few weeks ago, if you really are called Dante, you'd keep hold of that name. Confetti at 7.
I like it. You know, a semi-charming British comedy which works for two-thirds of its time, and when you consider the premise that it's people improvising three weddings, one of which is conducted as a naturist wedding, which sounds grisly, actually quite funny, quite cute, quite charming, liked it.
Daniel, even though he hasn't seen it, will still give it a line.
I suppose I was intrigued by the fact that it appears to have naked people in it. A movie called Confetti with naked people in it is always worth a glance.
When a Stranger Calls is number 6.
Not very good the first time round, but at least it had 15 minutes of good stuff at the beginning. The genius of the remake is that they've taken out the 15 minutes of good stuff at the beginning and just got down to it not being very good at all. It's taken three people to play the killer, and none of them are any good, and it's absolute bilge.
Daniel?
I'm very dismayed by the constant remaking of slasher films, mostly because they do seem to be cutting out the scares, and not only that, but cutting out also the violence and the nudity, which is really like remaking The Sound of Music and cutting out the nuns and Nazis.
Number five is waiting. And on the subject of waiting, this from Tim in Staffordshire. After last week's rantings from Mark, me and my friends decided to go and see Waiting instead. And now we know why Mark didn't review it. Utter rubbish from start to finish. I know it's a cliche, but it's true. I really did not laugh once. Waiting, yes, for the comedy. Hope X-Men 3 is an improvement, but the fear is there.
I've never heard of this Waiting. What is it? It's a Beckett biopic.
No, unfortunately, it's a film about waiters. It's a it's kind of like Clerks, but with all the jokes taken out of it. There are a bunch of guys. Mm. They're waiting at a restaurant that's called something Shenanigans with a Z at the end, and they all talk dirty to each other and talk rubbish. And it wants to have a sort of low budget indie feel, but sadly it doesn't. And can I just say that after what you just said about slasher movie remakes, you are my new best friend.
Oh, isn't that sweet? Why don't you take me to Cannes then, if I'm such a friend?
Well, you only just said it about a minute ago. I mean, if it had been before, then I would. Next year, I'll take you to. And incidentally, it's Cannes.
I'm from Calm. America. What do I know?
Well, you still pronounce it like the French do.
Oh, I was thinking of it as in Chaka.
Fair enough. Ice Age 2, The Meltdown at 4. And on that, Simon in Basingstoke says, this is a scary email. Two nights ago, I went to my local cinema to see the Ice Age sequel, mostly because I wanted to try the death of narrative cinema line. Just explain for Daniel and new listeners, Mark, what your challenge was.
Well, basically, to go and see Ice Age 2, which is a series of sketches which individually work but don't hang together as a narrative, and as you come out, say, I think it's symptomatic of the death of narrative cinema, very loudly, and see how far it gets you.
Okay, so Simon says, on my way out of the cinema, what was a reasonably full screening, I did indeed repeat the line, only for a voice behind to respond, well, hey, Kermode! Surprised, I turned round to see a nice looking young lady with whom I spent the rest of the evening discussing Ice Age 2 and various other films. We have now exchanged phone numbers and we'll be seeing each other again. Not what the good doctor intended, but thanks all the same. Ace Film Reviews are now matchmaking. Is there anything Dr. Kermode can't do? How about that?
I just think that's thrilling, and I would like them to keep us in touch with how things develop. You have to have the conversation about The Exorcist next, obviously, and then move on to Citizen Kane.
You are the new Walrus of Love, aren't you?
I am, yes, I am Barry White's love child.
Okay, so try chanting that line about the death of narrative cinema next time you leave Ice Age 2, and who knows, you may well end up with your future wife or husband or whatever. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. Prime's at 3.
Well, as we know, James King thinks it's good, for which crime he should be struck about the head with the newspaper, but obviously not our listeners. It's rubbish, and Uma Theakston should be ashamed of herself, and Muriel Strepsil clearly didn't have anything better to do other than collect the cheque. Although
all
she's
right,
quite
it's
good,
Streep,
but she's a different movie.
Mr. Can.
No, I know. I understand. But I'm not going to refer to... I'm not going to say Muriel Streep when she's in a movie this bad. Meryl Strepsil.
Mission Impossible 3, is it 2?
It actually is quite good. I just saw a thing on BBC World, a piece about how it had underperformed at the box office because it only took 47 million in its opening weekend.
What
and boy, would I like to underperform at 47. You know what? It's the best of the Mission Impossible movies, and I think that it is what it is, and I liked it, and I enjoyed it, and it went straight in one ear and out the other and left me partially blinded, with all the explosions. But I liked it. Hey.
Have you seen it, Daniel?
No, I haven't. I liked the first one, the Brian De Palma one, very much.
You're in that abroad position, aren't you, Mark? You're in that, haven't got anything to do, watch BBC World for a couple of hours.
And, it's actually very good.
It is
it's
very
a top
good.
News service that's available to people around the world.
Are
and
you
keeps
on
them
it?
In touch.
Right.
Box no.
And the UK's number one is the Tom Hanks film. And actually, on that subject, before
a genetic thriller for people who haven't seen it yet.
Indeed. Edward is on the phone. Hi, Edward.
Hi, Simon.
Okay, so you've heard the torrent of abuse coming from the good doctor. What did
yes.
you want to say about The Da Vinci Code?
Well, I've got to say that I thought The Da Vinci Code was a brilliant film. I was on the edge of my seat from start to finish, as was my brother. It was out of this world. I mean, maybe the doctor thinks it's some kind of documentary, I don't know, but it was just a good film. I've just watched X-Men 3, and I preferred The Da Vinci Code. It was out of this world. And I tell you something else I don't understand. What's wrong with the guy's hair? What is that? Is that what people do? They watch films and say, ooh, I don't like his hair. It was a great film, and there was no love. So what? People are being shot, you know what I mean? You expect to have romance in between murder.
Yeah, quite right. So, Mark, go on then. We've got Edward on the phone.
Okay, to respond to those in order, I'm amazed that it kept you on the edge of your seat. I mean, I was kept on the absolute threshold of sleep most of the time. So, but it's, you know, good to hear that that's the case. As far as Tom Hanks's hair is concerned, it's impossible to take your eyes off it. It is like somebody has actually stapled a strange fish-like creature to the top of his head.
It had no effect on me whatsoever. I don't see what the problem is.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
What's your own hair like?
Well, to be honest, I'm partially bald, and it's like a number five at the moment, so I don't know.
Okay, but you don't have the full mullet. It's not that you didn't notice the mullet because you actually are a mullet sporter yourself.
No. I took a glimpse of it.
I think if you're concerned about hair loss, you train yourself not to see hair. I think that's the explanation.
I don't think it is. I mean, to be honest, I don't think the hair is integral to the plot, you know? I watch a film because it's more than the hair, you know?
Okay.
I'm in politics, so I'm not really that vain.
Well, listen, I have to say...
But the hair is actually not unlike Jesus's, come to think of it, so maybe it is integral to the plot.
Hey, what can I say? I've seen God Be Born Day, you know what I mean?
Anyway, Edward, I think that's as far as we can take that. Thanks very much indeed for the call. This is Phil on... says, I listened to Mark on the podcast on Wednesday before I went to see The Da Vinci Code. He complained it was dark. Someone switched the light on, he said. Well, until they got to London, a good way into the film, it was night time. In our world, it's dark during the night. What does he expect? Having said that, the film is only average. Saoirse McKellen is the best thing about it. There was just no spark between Tom and Audrey. Pity, because the book is a good read. Keep up the good work. But it was night time, Mark. That's why it's dark.
Yeah. And can I answer that? Basically, and you're going to be really excited about this, there's been a great new invention. It's called electricity. And it enables people to... You've seen Catweasel. It enables people to turn on tiny, shining suns inside their house. So, amazingly, even when it is nighttime, it is possible to have light. And I advise you to embrace this new thing. Turn the light on.
Anyway,
the reason Howard doesn't turn the light on is because he knows if he turns the light on, everyone will go... Hang on, I can see what's going on, and you know what? It's rubbish.
We'll review X-Men 3 in just a moment. We've drifted somewhat from adverbs, Daniel. I apologise for that, but anyway, thanks
I think subliminally people are concerned for the novel and will now rush out to shops and buy it.
They will. What is your favourite adverb, by the way?
Very.
That was a bit dull, really.
That's sweet of you to say.
Daniel Handler's book is called Adverbs, as you might realise, and it appears to be a book of short stories, but isn't. Really. Daniel, may you sell another 50 million. Thanks very much
for coming.
That's
very sweet of you to say, sir. Thank you.
5 Live at 3:21. This email from Jag Group in Derby. Simon and Mark, after Mark's spectacular rant about the Da Vinci Code last week, I was nonetheless compelled to see said summer blockbuster, and I think it was fair to say that Mark was absolutely right about it. Hey. It was deathly dull, stupendously boring, far too long, and most hilariously of all, managed to take itself ridiculously seriously despite the inclusion of an unexpected, hilarious Bollywood-esque moment involving some dead grandparents at the end, except that Bollywood films do it better. I don't care about the book, I just want my summer blockbusters to be a little bit fun, at least. After declaring it utter tosh to my companions as we got up from our seats, I was incredibly tempted to say out loud that The Da Vinci Code was in fact the death of narrative cinema.
Narrative cinema.
Given that I hadn't seen Ice Age 2, but considering the bemused look on most people's faces as we left, I think it was safe to say that everyone pretty much would have agreed, and said statement would have been no shock whatsoever. Then has a question about Superman Returns, but as that's not out yet, we can return to that at some other stage. Hey, we're a bit far into the programme, but you ought to do a review or two, it seems to me.
Okay, X-Men The Last Stand. It's the X-Men 3, but they don't call things with the numbers anymore. There seems to be a general rule that you don't say it. And it's that old thing about the Americans didn't go and see Henry V because they hadn't seen parts 1 to 4 and they didn't know what happened up until now. But playing here, Horse de Competition, out of competition in Cannes, which means all the stars are in attendance, which meant that last night there was a very funny thing on television with like Saoirse McKellen and Halle Berry and Hugh Jackman on some Euro television programme like Scorchio from The Fast Show, you know, being harassed by a guy running around in a red superhero costume going, super fun, super fun, super fun, and they didn't look like they were having much super fun whatsoever. Anyway, story, such as there is one. The mutant hero is now facing the ultimate weapon in the form of a cure for their X-Men-ness, which prompts a fight between Patrick Stewart's tolerance, Charles Xavier character, and Saoirse McKellen's Magneto as to whether or not they should have a war about this. it's going to take a huge amount of money, so it doesn't make any difference what I say, but for what it's worth, the X-Men franchise was originally helmed by Bryan Singer, who was something of a latter-day auteur who directed Usual Suspects. This is helmed by Brett Ratner, who is a total uber hack, whose CV includes Rush Hour and Red Dragon, which was that abominable remake of Manhunter. Apparently, Brett Ratner's first five features have grossed nearly $1 billion, which tells you something really unpleasant about the state of Hollywood filmmaking. As you'd expect from a movie with this much clout behind it, the special effects are big and wizzo, with people sprouting wings and things going bang. But, as you'd expect from Brett Ratner, it has all the depth of a teaspoon, and despite the explosions, it managed to seem inordinately long and dragged out. Not as long and dragged out as The Da Vinci Code, but then Da Vinci Code had fewer explosions. The good stuff is it's got Famke Janssen doing a kind of Carrie impression and becoming possessed by her supernatural powers in a way which is almost borderline demonic. The bad stuff is like Halle Berry's character Storm, and her superpower is she can make the weather a bit bad, which, fine, if you live in California, a bit of bad weather must seem really scary, but for, you know, any of us who grew up in Barnet, if it's a bit of bad weather, who cares? It ends up like this just big dress-up pantomime, which reminded me of Batman and Robin, which was kicked all over town by the critics, but I thought was quite funny. But this isn't actually funny. It takes itself quite seriously. It doesn't have the camp buffoonery of Batman and Robin. It certainly doesn't have the intelligence or the insight of the previous Bryan Singer movies. And it's just more of the same, and it drags on, and everything goes boom, and then it ends. And it is billed as the climax of the X-Men motion picture trilogy, and certainly, as far as the plot's concerned, it would pretty much have to be the end. But if it takes money, I wouldn't completely rule out there being an X-Men 4. I would hope that this is it now, that this is the end. But you know, never say die when it comes to that kind of bankability.
John in Pontypridd says, I'm going to see X-Men 3 tonight, and since I am a disgusting comic geek, I just need to know one thing which will keep me happy for the next few hours. Does Iceman do an ice slide? This would make all my Spider-Man and his amazing friends' dreams come true.
Well, if he does, it didn't stick in my memory. Oh, the thing that stuck in my memory most was Vinnie Jones playing, at a real stretch, a meat-headed thug who runs through walls.
Right, so no news on Iceman or whether he does an ice slide or not.
There is, no, I don't. I mean, whenever I think of Iceman, I think of Frozone, and that's a different movie. I mean, I honestly don't remember him doing that. It didn't captivate me enough to make me make a note of it.
A number of people making this point, from like James in Manchester. Simon, how can you allow the good doctor to get away with any hair-based comments when he sports such an absurd Buffon quiff?
Well, you know, there's Buffon quiff, good. Horrible mullet, bad. Very simple. I mean, there is such a thing as right and wrong, and there is such a thing as a good and bad haircut. My haircut, good. Other people's haircuts, not good.
Jeremy on his says Rick Astley springs to mind.
Oh, well, excuse me. Rick Astley wouldn't know a can of Dax if it fell on him.
Tom in Edinburgh. Approximately 10 minutes after listening to Mark's hilarious rant about Da Vinci last week, my girlfriend and I got a call inviting us to the 11 p.m. showing of said film. Didn't have anything better to do, so we thought, what the heck? 10 minutes in, 1 out of 4 of our group was asleep. 40 minutes in, 3 out of 4 were asleep. I remained awake for the entirety, but I feel as though the Sleeping Beauties were the lucky ones. The only good thing to come out of it, out of this turgid film, was Mark's review.
Very good. Well, I'm glad to hear that something good came of it.
And the only mysterious thing, according to Simon in Knots, about the Da Vinci Code, was at the end when an Austin Mini and a Morris Traveller transform into a Rover 75 and Range Rover. Did anyone else notice? We'll leave it there, leave it hanging, and if people did, they will tell us. mayo@bbc.co.uk. Let's clear up the X-Men 3 correspondence. Derek in Edinburgh. Having followed Dr. Kermode's attempts to make a shout about the death of narrative cinema to all at the end of a film, I came desperately close to doing it at the end of X-Men 3. A flashy effects-heavy film and lots of characters, no explanations, while the band moved from CG scene to CG scene. At least Singer had the decency to try and put some plot strands in there, although I now feel that any sequels will focus on big bangs than a good story. Another franchise goes for the easy money. What a shame. This from Darren. Saw X-Men 3 last night. Thought it was definitely the best of the three. Pierce in Dublin went to see X-Men 3 yesterday. Came out thinking it was 100 times better than The Godfather Part 3, but still disappointing if you care at all for the characters. If you're an X-Men fan, you will hate how some of the main characters are dealt with. If you're not an X-Men fan, you'll probably go and see The Da Vinci Code instead. Not quite sure who this movie is for. And a few points from Rakesh Jassy on... this, he says, I've been a huge X-Men fan all my childhood and latter years, I was pleased when someone like Bryan Singer brought the series to life on the big screen, especially number two, where I could argue that it's one of the best sequels ever. Now then, I was really worried when I heard rumours that they had hired Brett Ratner to make it and have what... How did he get it so wrong? Brett Ratner should never be allowed to make a film again. I know he's just agreed to do Rush Hour 3 and Chris Tucker is getting... certain amount. I am just dumbfounded. So there, I'm just an upset X-Men fan. You know, Paul Greengrass would have kicked ass if he'd made it. So
he would have done. I think that first email completely nailed it. And whoever it was that sent in, that's a very, very good critique of what's wrong with that film.
And now, without further ado, Mark, you can introduce one of your favourite men in the universe, because I think you just do it better than I would.
Well, shall I tell you something about the film first, or shall I just say, ladies and gentlemen...
It would be rude to keep him hanging on the phone from New York any longer than he is.
Okay, William Friedkin.
Hello, Mark. How you guys doing?
Very good. How are you?
Good. So it's interesting to listen to 15 straight reviews of X-Men. That was... really the highlight of my day.
Hey, William, this is Simon in the studio. I'd just like to point out it's my show and Mark is just my movie reviewer, okay?
Okay.
We're getting it the right way around.
All right.
But it is fantastic to have you on the show and appreciate you talking to us today. Mark has seen your movie, so before we hear what he has to say about it, let's hear your version, William.
My version of what?
Of your new movie. We need to know about it because only Mark amongst us has seen it.
Well, you know, I don't think it's... going to serve any purpose to describe the plot. I don't really like to hear the plot of anything, including something like Hamlet. If you reduce it to the plot, it's just a load of tosh, isn't it?
Okay, what would you like to tell us about it before we hear what Mark has to say about
it? It's a very intense piece of work. I think Mark will agree. It's it kind of captures the spirit that I feel rampant, not only in the United States, but elsewhere where I travel, especially in Europe, of kind of irrational fear and paranoia. Although it's specifically deals with five characters in a little town just outside of Oklahoma City.
I think, did you get the idea when you went to see the play, I think?
Yeah, the play immediately struck me as being very cinematic, very disturbing and provocative, which I think are two reasons to make a film. There may not be too many more. A third, of course, would be just sheer entertainment. But then at a certain point, when you have made enough films, you want to try and take the audience somewhere they haven't been.
So you wanted to make a movie out of it. I think your other half thought you were mad.
Well, you know, that's what you've obviously read Roger Ebert's review.
I had Mark read it out to me over the phone from Cannes this morning.
Yeah, no, I mean, she loved the play and thought it was, when we saw it together, and she thought it was very powerful. But then, you know, I don't know that anyone who, let's say, saw X-Men at 11 o'clock last night would look at this play and say, geez, there's a wonderful film in that.
Okay, Mark, we're going to turn to you for a little bit of the plot. I understand that William doesn't want to do that, so you can, and tell us what you think.
Well, the way I'd describe it is, I'd say it's, you know, it's an intense psychosexual paranoid thriller. And I think it's the purest work that Friedkin's done in many years.
What do you mean by that?
Well, because it's completely uncompromising. It's not a film that makes any kind of concessions to a mainstream audience. And I think it's very important that when I saw it, it completely divided the audience. Some people walked out because they just couldn't take it. Some people, like me, thought this is, you know, a masterpiece. And funnily enough, I was out with Steve Woolley, the producer, last night, and he agreed with me about how intense and how good it was. But it's cut people right down the middle. I think it's got terrific performances. I've never seen Ashley Judd on this kind of form before. Really, really intense performance. And it's one of those, it's a play about descent into self-generating paranoia that takes the audience to a very crazy place and then just keeps going. It's genuinely frightening, it's genuinely involving, it's stripped down and, you know, brutal and raw in a way that I think that all of Friedkin's best work is. And I mean, I have to say, as somebody who's a lifelong Friedkin fan, I thought it was right back on form, right up there with, you know, his best work. And I've told Billy as much. As it's, I was just absolutely chuffed as nuts by it. And personally, it's the thing I've enjoyed most here in Cannes this year.
Well, what can I say, Mark? I couldn't have said it better myself. I was hoping that at the very least, it would have a reaction like the one you've described that was similar to the first performance of Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring as a ballet in 1913 in Paris, where the audience literally got up and started screaming at each other and at the performers and pounding each other over the head, and it was an out-and-out riot in the theater. I mean, how many films are you going to see, or even plays today, that are going to excite you to any sort of an emotional pitch? There was a time in American theater when this would happen. There was a play in the 1930s called Awake and Sing by Clifford Odets, and it was a time when the labor movement was on the rise. And at the end of this play, the actors on the stage all come forward and yell, "Strike! Strike! Strike!" And the whole theater audience, for every performance, echoed it, echoed the cry of strike. Now, we don't have that kind of theater anymore. We don't have it in cinema. People sit back. They might enjoy what they're watching or not, but they don't get emotionally involved. And that was something that I really wanted to try to do.
William, what is it in the film that would make someone want to stand up and leave the cinema, which Mark said happened at his screening?
Oh, I don't know. I think audiences today are a bit more skittish. You know, they don't expect to be moved on that level. They don't expect to be challenged or provoked. Mark, I don't imagine anyone, you know, sitting at the average CGI $200 million negative cost film, it wants anything more out of it than to be entertained and maybe see a bit of skin or something.
Mark, why were people walking out, do you know?
Well, I think they were because basically the movie is completely full on. It doesn't sort of do any of the things that you'd expect conventional nice narrative to do. It, like I said, it starts going into a point of paranoid conspiracy madness, and then it just simply keeps going. What most cinema does nowadays is kind of wimps out and kind of gives you a breathing space and doesn't really follow through on its convictions. The thing that I really liked about Bug, and I would challenge anybody to disagree with this, whether you like the film or not, it sets itself a task and then it does it. And it was to get people to walk out of films is quite something, because mainly, you know, as we heard from when people talking about the X-Men or people talking about Da Vinci Code, you can not like a movie or not be very engaged with it, but just sit there to the end for 2.5 hours. It takes something to annoy them enough to make them go, I can't do this anymore. And I really, the feeling that Billy's talking about in the cinema was happening in the screening that I saw. You know, it was genuinely terrorizing some parts of the audience.
Absolutely. just one thing, William, before you leave us, will you please tell Mark to stop going on about The Exorcist?
Is he still doing that?
Oh.
I mean, well, look, he knows a quality act when he sees it. But the point is, I'd like to make one point, which I might have tried before the cricket scores, but which is, I don't intend for people to walk out, to get up and walk out. But one of the things, to try to explain it to you, I think that audiences are and have been conditioned to be a lot more squeamish today about things. And it's not anything actual that you're seeing that's disturbing you. It's the overall peace. More or
exactly.
Less the way people were disturbed in 1960 by Psycho. There were people who left the theater, walked out, and The Exorcist, you know, and maybe a handful of films where the experience was too intense.
William,
can I just say that I agree with that entirely, because it's not a visually explicit film. It's a thematically intense film, and it's the atmosphere of it, and that's exactly the point. And I think that's a real triumph.
William,
well, it's good to talk to you guys.
And thank you very much.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much indeed for your time today, William. Brian in Derby says, as an American, Mark, I'm offended by your crack about Americans not going to see Henry V because they hadn't seen parts 1 through 4. Having said that, I couldn't bring myself to see Malcolm X. Missing the first 9 is just too much to overcome.
Can I just say that is a very, very fine joke?
It's not bad, is it? It didn't provoke.
It's not bad at all, particularly for an American.
Jeff Gillespie, listening in Tokyo. If you look up the word bemused, Simon, in the dictionary, you're very likely to see a picture of the audience I went to see The Da Vinci Code with in a Tokyo suburb last weekend. Being almost totally a secular society and with just about nobody having read the book, it was a sublime mixture of not knowing and not caring. I do not predict good business over here. Oh, and the man is right. Dull, dull, dull. Ben in Ealing, I enjoyed The Da Vinci Code. The plot and the dialogue is simple. The theme is interesting. This is really all I require of a blockbuster since, unlike Mark, I have an intellectually challenging day job and therefore get my intellectual kicks elsewhere. Which is an interesting point, actually. Mark Lawson was writing about this, saying that the difference between everyone who goes to the movies and the critics is because you're doing your day job, we're trying to get away from ours.
Yeah, but the problem with Da Vinci Code is you don't get away from anything. You sit there, and because you're so bored, you think, did I leave the gas on? Have I paid that bill? What am I going to do next Tuesday? Is so-and-so coming round this week? That's what you do. I mean, for me, the great failure of it is that it doesn't take you out of yourself, which it should do. It puts you right back there, sitting with a numb bum, wondering when it's going to end. And incidentally, because I assume he's listening, hello, Mark Lawson.
What else is new, Mark?
Down in the Valley, which is better than X-Men 3, sort of post-Badlands, latter-day suburban Western, set in what is described in the press notes as the cultural no-man's land of the San Fernando Valley. They said it, not me. I mean, San Fernando Valley, known for many things, for silicone, for pornography, for that film 2 Days in the Valley and the film Valley Girls. Anyway, Ed Norton stars as this borderline delusional gas station worker who talks in that kind of, oh, shucks, ma'am, way that John Voight did in Midnight Cowboy, sports a cowboy hat, sort of has delusions of being a cowboy. Very early on, abandons his job to go to the beach with a teenage girl, played by Evan Rachel Wood, who's from 13. He falls for her. They start having, I mean, if you've seen Badlands, you're kind of familiar with this, they start having an awkward, strange, slightly off-kilter relationship. And so, inevitably, as you'd expect, things start to go badly wrong. Her father, played by David Morse, who's a brilliant actor, hates him. He starts to develop a kind of unhealthy relationship with her brother, who's played by Rory Culkin. Weirdness and death ensues. Now, the film itself is okay. It's moody, it's sweaty, it's got quite a nice tactile feel to it, or it's not entirely original. As I said, it does owe a debt to Badland. It also makes a mistake of quoting directly from 70s classics like Taxi Driver, and the director David Jacobson cites things like Red River as his visual inspiration. The problem with ever calling up those kind of films to mind is that whenever I see a film that cites Taxi Driver, all I think is, yeah, and this isn't Taxi Driver, and it isn't Taxi Driver by quite some distance. That said, Ed Norton is a great actor, and he's done some really good work in the past. I mean, people will know him from Fight Club, from that awful Red Dragon thing in which we've got back, which he was the best thing. He is a very, very fine actor, and he does a real good job. He has got his work cut out for him because he's up against David Morse, and David Morse is one of those people who he's not considered to be a superstar in the sort of public perception, and yet he is always good in everything he's in. He's in 16 Blocks, of course, and he acts Bruce Willis and Mos Def or Gertrude Stein, you know, off the screen completely. He always brings gravitas to a role. And then, to top it all, you get a cameo by Bruce Dern as a mad rancher, and it is only a cameo, and that's pretty much what Bruce Dern does now. He turns up and does mad cameos, but I love Bruce Dern. I mean, I've loved him ever since Silent Running, and I think he's very fine. So it's worth seeing for the performances, and it's certainly worth seeing for Ed Norton's performance. I just don't think that as itself as a movie, it's not the most original thing you're going to see. But when you put it next to X-Men 3, or X-Men Last Stand, as we're officially calling it, it is, as we always say, it's clearly Citizen Kane, because it's actually got real characters who really do some things that you believe in.
We don't always say, you always say. You've got 60 seconds to tell us anything else of interest at Cannes this week?
Other stuff that's been going on. Well, Fast Food Nation cameoed, which is this kind of Richard Linklater adaptation of the book by Eric Schlosser. People were kind of down on it because they said it takes the edge off the Schlosser book. I rather liked it. Southland Tales, which is the new movie by Richard Kelly, who made Donnie Darko, is absolutely terrible. We saw it here in a 2-hour and 40-minute version, which I guarantee you will never see the light of day again. It's going to have to be cut down because it's nonsense. Inconvenient Truth, the Al Gore movie. Al Gore turned up to introduce his movie, in which he does this long lecture about global warming. And as with all Al Gore stuff, you know, its heart's in the right place and it means well. But he has had a charisma bypass and he is a bit of a plank. And then I walked out of a film. I walked out of this film, Zidane, which is a film about that footballer.
Zidane, yes.
Yeah, the whole film is the camera trained on him during a football match. I got to half time and thought, I've had enough of this. I left and therefore missed the twist, which at the end of the match, he got sent off.
Michael, on a theme, Apollo 13, I missed it, and I also missed the first 12. Anyway, Mark, have a great time at Cannes. See you on News Night Review. Phil is here next week, and you'll find that Drive is next on AM, on digital, and online. You're listening to Five Live.